your morning is energetic and exciting because we're going to talk about all the depressing things that come with technology. And some of the good. This is the panel about the techlash. We'll think deeply about that process. I had not heard the term until I heard about this panel, and so I'm glad that we now have a term to define this thing that we're all experiencing in real life and on Twitter. And so I'll just start by introducing myself. My name's Carl Grindel. I'm a member of the Electronic Frontier Georgia, which is hosting this event through the Electronic Frontier Forum.
Yeah.
Sign up over there.
Thank you.
Come to the meeting.
And also a PhD student here at Georgia Tech, where I research cybersecurity policy. And so happy to be moderating this morning panel. I thought we'd start by just doing introductions of the panelists and touch upon one way that the techlash is affecting your work, just so we can start to think about what might this entail. All right, let's start down at the end.
Sure, glad to. Hey, everybody, and rate this panel in your app. You rate it now, you already know it's top notch, 5, just put it in there. All right, so my name is Andrew Greenberg. I'm the executive director of the Georgia Game Developers Association. Been working in games for a long, long time. And obviously, video games have been the scapegoat for a whole host of ills. An amazing litany no one would ever have expected. In fact, one of the games I worked on back in the early 90s got blamed for deaths at Columbine and all of the sorts of... I didn't work on Doom Vampire, which was the only tabletop that got blamed as well. So I was the original developer of Vampire. Yeah, we got blamed. We also had blame for some card players who killed somebody. It's just the immediate scapegoat, and when people don't want to deal with what the real causes are, the fact they got into games late doesn't... Obviously, it's far more important than everything in their childhood from 0 to 13 or whatever. But by the same token, this has been an ongoing battle. I've been working with the International Game Developer Association's anti-censorship special interest group on this, and the policy group, doing this with the GGDA, and it is amazing how much the conversation has shifted. We were, at one point, games were the scapegoat by everyone in power. Now it is a very distinct group in power, and the others are now coming out defense. It's been an amazing shift that can change when whoever's in power changes over again and someone else in power needs a scapegoat. But for now, it is interesting to see how little traction the games are bad and K litany gets.
I'm breaking the queue here. Andrew, did you write Berlin by Night?
I was the developer of it.
Oh my god. Please
continue. I wrote a good chunk of it, but
you're responsible for a good portion of my high school experience. I play so much Old World of Darkness.
It's a vampire panel now, I'm sorry.
Tremere for life. So my name is Eric Rose. I work in Washington, D.C. for a group called Public Knowledge. We are a consumer advocacy organization that works primarily on tech and communications issues, and that will range all the way from copyright, which is my traditional beat, down to net neutrality, down to privacy, down to antitrust and competition issues, to spectrum allocation at the FCC for wireless devices, which is 100% not my beat, so please don't ask me questions about it, because I won't be able to speak intelligently. Techlash, we've always been in this space, and there has historically been antipathy between the tech industry and some older extant industries. Pick your industry. News publishing, not a fan of tech and Google in particular, hasn't been for a long time. And copyright, where I work a lot with music copyright. So you want to talk about some of the OG techlash comes around, music and file sharing and piracy and piracy. And I think techlash has affected my work pretty directly because it has given a sort of veneer or a cover to a lot of things that have gotten through. These are folks who have historically really, you know, had agendas that are at odds with tech companies, and in a lot of cases against what we consider the public interest. But because it is harder and harder to find people who are willing, who are elected officials in particular, who are willing to stand up and, like, you know, protect big bad Google or Facebook or whatever, it makes it a lot harder to find allies on some of these issues if you happen to take a position that would align to the interests of the tech companies, which sometimes we do and sometimes we don't. But when we do, it becomes substantially harder than it used to be to find allies in this stuff.
Thank you.
So my name is Amy Stupanovich. I am the executive director of Silicon Flatirons at Colorado Law School. I've had that job for about a month. So I'm really new, so the way that this has affected my work is also something I'm still learning at the new job. I want to actually first by apologizing because I've been on a few panels and they've all been super depressing and I don't know if this was going to be any better. So, like, sorry for, like, being up here and being, like, the person who drags your day down. Hopefully we can, like, get that out of the way and you can have a really great afternoon instead of DragonCon. And in light of being positive, I think one of the ways that I feel interestingly confident, like wavering levels of confidence in saying this has affected my current job, is before I left, we just started the semester, and we had a huge number of students really interested in our center. We're the Tech Policy Center at the law school. We work on entrepreneurship in all areas of tech policy. And a lot of students came out and were super interested in getting involved. And I think they said it was more than we've ever had before in the first week of first-year law students trying to figure out what we do. And I think some of that is because of the techlash. The issues around technology have been in the news in every single area that we work on, from copyright to privacy to artificial intelligence. And they're interesting, complicated issues, despite what the headlines and the things that you see on Twitter might have you believe. And so people are really, I think, newly trying to figure out how do you solve these and what is that going to mean. And that means more people getting involved in the space. One of my pet issues is trying to better diversify the tech space, which is super, super necessary. And I mean gender, race, background, the number of people who come from poor or underserved areas that are in the tech space is quite small in Washington, D.C. And so now I have left Washington, D.C. after 10 years and am living in Boulder, Colorado, which is a whole different world, and I'm trying to bring more people into that. And so having more students interested is actually a really great thing, and I hope that we can serve some of those goals that I have for the center.
Hi, I'm Jairus Khan. I work for Mozilla Foundation, probably best known for Firefox. I work on the nonprofit foundation policy tech end of it, and the techlash has been has had a huge impact on my work for a couple of reasons. One, because when it comes to actual consumer behavior, our browser is the only browser most people can think of that's made by a nonprofit. So we actually have a lot of people kind of realizing maybe using a browser by companies that are for-profit and have kind of different goals in mind is maybe not good. But I actually work on the browser end of things. I work on a report called the Internet Health Report, which is kind of a human-level examination of the way that the internet is impacting people across the world. And so the techlash is really central to a lot of the work that we do, because we look at the people who are impacted by the things that are causing the techlash. And then we also kind of look at the ways in which the techlash is impacting people who rely on those services that there is a techlash against. So it is really kind of fundamental to a lot of the work I do. And the report that came out, not the most recent one, but the year before, came out on the day Zuckerberg was in front of Congress. So it is really kind of intrinsically tied to what's happening in tech, the way people are responding to it, and whether it is or is not good for people.
Thank you. So let's try to figure out what this word means. We've all used it to describe ways that it's affected our work. So techlash, what makes this different from being anti-science? And why aren't we all techno-utopians anymore?
I can Yeah, I know some of us don't really work. For some of us, what got us into tech policy was the Matrix. I joke, but no, I think, you know, it's not, I think the anti-science equivalency is not a good one. You know, there is certainly a large part of the techlash that is driven by fundamental misunderstanding of how the technology works. I think what in my mind is a more sort of, I don't want to say legitimate, but a more grounded portion of it is about the business models of the particular companies that are utilizing this tech. It's how do we, you know, when you start running up, you have companies that exercise, you know, and some of this is, it goes all the way back to like trust busting era, of like you have companies that have control over massive amounts of what we consider to be necessary services for participation in modern society. You know, go back to the Bell companies, right, the telephone network. Go back to, and I'm not suggesting Facebook is like a telephone network, but you know, we do, they are, it is very integrated, some of these services, into just how we participate in civil society. It's how we communicate with one another. It's something that, by virtue of its own success, has in some aspects become not quite indispensable, but very hard to dispense of. And that runs up against the very real, you know, capitalistic factor of maximizing profit in some cases. And I think there is a very intelligent, well, sometimes very intelligent discussion going on around how do we reconcile those two aspects. And I think that's one conversation that's going on. The other conversation is tech very bad. Tech bad, tech evil, tech source of all problems. Tech incapable of doing anything good. And then I think there's also kind of, you know, the weaponized nostalgia of a time before Facebook, of a time, and weaponized nostalgia is like a very old political tool, but we're just starting to see it come out again. You know, it's you see it in industries, so like the news industry, which is facing a lot of like very legitimate problems about how do you, news writing and reporting has always been precarious financially. It has always been like this. If you go all the way back to the golden age of newspapers, they were financed by the local town philanthropist. It was found, they would be financed by like one company or one local family was basically the model. And then, you know, we've gotten up to modern day and all of a sudden now you have tech companies and so they're in some real trouble. But there's this idea that like, well, if we just go back to the print circulation and put up paywalls, then it'll all be fine. And it's like, well, no, it actually won't. There's just your business model underneath that. We've never come up with a sustainable business model for this. And tech has maybe like emphasized that problem and put an exclamation point at the end of it, but it hasn't caused it. And so I think tech lash is when tech becomes a very convenient scapegoat for a lot of other underlying problems that are happening in a lot of these markets. I see this in music all the time. The music industry is a deeply exploitative industry, and it is, yeah, I know this might be news to some people. It's deeply screwed up, and there are a lot of reasons for that that are, and some of them are, you know, the way we've structured legally around the industry, some of them are, a lot of them are just internal to the way the business models have developed, and the inertia and the inherent bargaining discrepancy between an individual artist and a record label. But if you ask the record labels, the reason that artists aren't getting paid is because Spotify isn't paying out enough money. Spotify just became profitable for the first time about 10 months ago. It's been going for over a decade, and it took them like millions and millions of subscribers to finally turn a profit. So always view these kinds of claims with skepticism. And all of this is a very long way of saying, I think techlash is when you start putting a veneer of it's all the fault of the tech companies on other problems that have deeper, more systemic causes.
And some of the fault, I'm not gonna do well with the mic during this panel, some of the fault for this goes to the tech companies. And while I feel actually some, mark my words on this, this is like, while I feel some empathy for the companies and that they're getting criticism for things that are both really highly valid and really kind of not, they have pushed us in a way toward this. If you've worked in tech policy at all the last 10 years, you will know that innovation is like been the buzzword and the thing that gets around all regulation. Let's put some privacy laws in place. No, it'll hurt innovation. Let's look at taxes. No, it'll hurt innovation. Let's look at freedom of expression and the harassment, the horrible harassment problem on the internet. No, that will hurt innovation. And so this word gets trotted out a lot, and anything that undermines innovation has been seen as something like, let's leave that aside, we can't talk about that, we can't touch it. And now we come full circle, and these huge problems have been allowed to continue to exist, to not be solved, to not be even really talked about in a meaningful way in some cases. And they've gotten bigger and worse, and now people want to solve them. And so I think some of the hyperbole, what we do hear in the tech, anti-tech space, comes from feeling like the companies have for too long ignored the problems and let them get bigger and worse. And we should never have done that. We should have been addressing these all along. And now we're now. And there are 50,000 issues. I've said for the last couple of years, the tech policy space is getting DDoS'd, or basically like denial of service attacked. There are too many things happening, and you can't respond to all of them. It's just like you're frozen in terror, staring at the issues you have to deal with, because we haven't been dealing with them in the last decade.
Yeah. To just piggyback on that quickly, the reality of a lot of tech companies that are the ones that we're arguing about is, with the notable exception probably of Twitter, a lot of them are very big, multifaceted giants. So if you talk about a solution to one problem that comes up, what are the ripple effects on another part of that ecosystem? Like, you know, if you create obligations for certain things, how does that impact other stuff? And you know, how do you talk about training on privacy and security? You know, especially you can get, I am not Matt Blaze, but I will channel Matt Blaze and say, voting is very complicated, and using blockchain for voting is generally not a good idea, because it's individually identified. And so there are, it has to be a holistic approach. Otherwise, you're going to say something that is going to have a ripple effect all the way out there, and it becomes very difficult to have the conversation without thinking at that kind of scale.
Yeah, I think these are some of the core factors behind the TechLash. I do want to talk about one good thing technologists can do, which is to give to the DragonCon charity. Sorry, Scott wanted to do this at the beginning. Scott, you want your cue? Go for it. You can give to the DragonCon charity, which is?
American Heart Association.
American Heart Association. So, sorry, this was supposed to be this at the beginning. But secondly, I now want to take this away from being a vampire panel to being a Fading Suns panel. So that's another game that developed, which really the key aspect is TechLash. The idea is that humanity reaches the stars, creates a perfect society, and fucks it all up. And you're left behind in the ruins. And the technology part is key to it. It was our feeling that the anti-science trend we see is very much people feel that it is a confrontation of their core values. Evolution has to be bad and has to be wrong, et cetera, et cetera. But the backlash against technology comes more from the failure of it to live up to our views of what it was going to provide. And we very much talk about this in our Fading Suns game, where humanity thinks that technology doing all these incredible things is going to make every life perfect and fulfilled, and life is still what it's always been, which is not perfect and fulfilled unless you somehow magically make that happen. And it becomes the target for the resentment that it's not providing what you felt you were promised, what the people in our game felt they were promised. And as a result, they see the technologists at the highest heights reaping in the benefits and view that they have been sold a bill of get the goods. It was never correct from the beginning. Now, the technologists might have their own point of view on what they were actually promising all along, but really they're promising a company that was making money. And when it's not providing it or being used in other ways, it is a very convenient target. In addition, I talk about games being a scapegoat. There are definitely issues we have to deal with in games and all aspects of technology. Everyone's working in public policy because there are aspects to deal with. But there are also those people who feel they benefit from that backlash against technology for whatever reason and will focus it accordingly. The games example is clear. We know who's making games a scapegoat and their right reasons for it. We see that clearly. But the other technologies, you often have very similar forces saying, we're going to blame, this is all Facebook's fault, let's not look at the other underlying issues, et cetera.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I think that when it comes to TechLash, specifically a big part of it is the emotional movement that is, I think, underlying TechLash really comes from a sense of helplessness that a lot of people feel. I think that, people look at their technology, so much of it is unknowable, especially when you talk about things like machine learning and AI, and people don't really know what it is or how it works. They just know that, you know, Facebook appears to be reading their mind, and they're seeing these ads, and they see, you know, they get notifications that there's 50 different breaches, and their passwords are compromised everywhere. And I think there's this overwhelming feeling that it doesn't really matter what you do if you're part of the ecosystem, or even if you're not, maybe there's shadow profiles and they capture your stuff anyway. And so I think a big part of the TechLash is people feeling this overwhelming sense of helplessness, like they're part of a rigged system, there isn't anything they can do about it, and finally we at least know what companies are the big ones that we can look at. And I think that I agree with everything my co-panelist said, but I think that the feeling of there's nothing I can do about it, but I'm looking for a target to lash out, and I'm not saying that's invalid, but I think the kind of opaqueness of how technology works and the way that these business models work is a big contributor to it.
And AI is going to take my job.
So because this topic is so political, I think it's interesting to ask, like, look at the critics, and they come from both sides of the political spectrum. So both President Trump has held meetings criticizing the tech companies, inviting social media figures online that claim some form of censorship. Sanders has released plans that would also sort of change the tax system to affect mostly targeting Amazon. What distinguishes these two critiques? And in what ways do either of them match with your understanding of the challenges?
So I think...
Yeah, true.
Microphone issues are real.
Yeah.
So I think this gets back to there are legitimate and illegitimate criticisms to have here, or legitimate and overblown. And I'll talk specifically about the speech issue online. There is a huge harassment and threat issue online, and you only have to have looked at the monstrous volume of speech calling women horrible things and threatening to rape them, the gamer dates, and they're like, it pushes people off platforms and allows platforms to be dominated by the privileged few, as opposed to the people who are having these threats lobbied against them. That is a real problem that requires a response in a really in-depth situation. However, on the other side, what we're hearing is this: there is political bias that is keeping speech off the internet and different fora, Facebook, Twitter, etc. And everybody who I know who has looked at this from an expert perspective has shown that that is not necessarily the case. That side of things doesn't have the political or the scientific evidence to back it up. But it's creating a need for companies to respond on two different fronts to these legitimate and these very, very overblown criticisms. And that's actually preventing them from finding a singular solution, because the solution might make this side angry. And so where are they? I think some of them are coming from legitimate places. Some of them are coming from, it is politically expedient to have this point of view that criticizes technology, because it gets me in the news more. It is taking advantage of the tech lash and the negative feeling people have toward tech. And having those two points of view, and both sides of the aisle do it. I'm not picking on one side or the other. Having those two points of view actually make it harder to find a solution, because the solution to the actual problem frequently will contradict the overblown problem. And that's where we end up with a lot of this. With Facebook, we're not moving forward on privacy laws because we're so busy talking about other issues that we can't just dig down and get a privacy law that would have solved a huge majority of the Facebook Cambridge Analytica piece that people are so upset about. And so I think it's political expedience, and it's crowding the solutions out.
You know, I think one thing to consider is that platforms are designed by people. They're designed by people who have a very necessarily individual or maybe community defined set of expectations as to what other people need. So we've run into this with things like Tumblr. So Tumblr and the ban of female presenting nipples, which is a subject of a wild panel last night, if you got to see it. I work a lot with fandoms. And the Venn diagram of fandoms and the queer community overlaps quite a bit. And especially, you know, fandoms tend to skew young, non-cisgender male, and, you know, that whole spectrum, and queer. And there are particular things that fandoms value in a space. There are particular things that queer communities, and specifically younger queer communities, value in a space, and certain kinds of tools they need, and certain kinds of architecture that they want. Those aren't being provided for them by a large platform. So part of what I study is, like, where do fandoms migrate to? Like, when something gets shut or shuttered, or you have the purge, you know, the strike through on fanfiction.net, like, where do people go? What kind of things do they value in having a platform? And Tumblr seems like a pretty good ecosystem. And then sort of a fundamental disconnect between the people who owned and managed the site and a huge swath of their user base, which, you know, as someone put it to me the other day, everyone is horny on Maine. you know, that sex is for a large portion of these communities, or at least a non-zero portion of these communities, is just part of the dialogue that they engage in. And, you know, for the people who run and manage the site and who design the site, they maybe didn't think of it that way, and they're like, well, no, there's too much porn on this. We need to get rid of the porn. And it's like, okay, well, now you've nerfed a huge part of, like, what this community engages in is speech. And I think, you know, my point is that the values of a platform are often, at least in the beginning, when it is originally constructed or reflect the values of the people constructing it. They do not necessarily reflect the values of the people using it. And that is true on both sides of the spectrum. I mean, this is when you get to things like the complaints about political bias against, you know, political bias against conservatives, which, you know, to reiterate what Amy said, statistically, there just isn't any evidence of this happening. At least nothing large or convincing. And, you know, this idea of, like, well, I expect my speech to be carried in a specific way because this is what I, members of my community, expect to be happening. And then on the other side, you have, well, this is the kind of dialogue that members of my community want and need to be engaging in. And then you have a platform in the middle who is designed by neither of these groups, who is just like, well, I guess we'll do nothing. And we won't ban the Nazis from Twitter. Thanks, Jack. You know, and they just get kind of caught in this weird feedback loop of trying to address non-problems and then taking the oxygen out of the room to deal with the real ones.
And I think Meredith is bringing up a great point. That there is stuff that we really have to examine in the TechLash and pull the valuable aspects out of it. In gaming, we've had to address for 20 years the fact that we just can't say, I'm just a game designer, I have to worry about any of this. We have a responsibility not just to our company, but to our users and to our community, our society, and in a sense, the world. And that's become much more evident within the gaming industry. Even the large companies like Riot are making some efforts to address some of the more toxic things, and they understand that it is necessary for their users and also for their corporate survival. And certainly, I think that the TechLash by marginalized communities has finally gained enough traction that there is an understanding that we're hurting the technology industry by not bringing all these communities into the fold. And it's not just that, oh, we should be fair and include everyone, which we should, but more importantly, including more diverse voices in and a wider swath of voices means we'll speak to more people and make more money, to be honest. And that's definitely something that the game industry has noticed. So I will speak on behalf of the TechLash to say that we in the industry should never just say, oh, it's unwarranted, it has no value. I personally am disgusted at the ads I get on YouTube. As soon as you start looking at miniature gaming on YouTube, historical war gaming, you're getting some wacko ads coming down your way. And I would love for YouTube to finally address it. Twitter obviously has some things to just, for all of us who are on BBSs back in the 80s, you know how noxious that stuff was. I'm glad those servers got bulldozed back already. And that stuff is not out there anymore. But Yeah, 4chan, 8chan, before that existed. But in any case, we know that that is out there, and it doesn't do us any good to ignore it.
I think when it comes to the TechLash end of it, I think the question of the role marginalized people play in it is super interesting, because I feel like the way it kind of used to work is a lot of these backlashes, whether you look back in the satanic panic of the 80s, you know, and Dungeons & Dragons is going to send a kid to hell, or whether it was, you know, people who played Doom or whatever. Often, and it's tough to imagine this at Dragon Con with a zillion people and the Marvel movies are the biggest movies in the world, but there was a time when being a nerd was to be marginal. And I think that there was a time where a lot of those kind of panics were, oh, we're afraid of the thing the marginalized people are doing. We're afraid of gay people. We're afraid of whatever. And now a lot of the lash is coming from marginalized people who are like, we're tired of you fucking with us, right? Like, if we can't be on Tumblr and we can't be on LiveJournal, and if we go to Twitter, there's a bunch of Nazis there, what do you want us to do? And I think that the balance of power has kind of shifted, or not the balance of power, but the way in which the tech lash approaches power has changed, because I think it really used to be a tool of systemic oppression, and now it is a recognition of systemic oppression and an emotional response to that.
Yeah, and I mean, during the height of Gamergate, we brought Zoe Quinn to Atlanta to speak at Siege. She was dealing with, you know, security issues at the very height of it. And what was very clear at that time was that a lot of that was coming from sock puppet accounts. And we see it to this day. We have a female-owned game dev studio here in Georgia, Kerchunk Games, does great stuff. But you'll see these sock puppets with the only other followers or other sock puppet accounts suddenly making
some
stupidity.
Everybody knows those are. No, I want to explain.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'm speaking with my own mouth, but I've got two sock puppets on these hands retweeting it from other accounts saying, oh boy, you're right, Andrew. Boy, Andrew, that was the best point anyone ever made. Now it sounds like three people are making the same asinine assumption that I've made. So they are the same and going through multiple accounts to whine and scream and complain or sell, click on ads and generate money that way.
And differentiated from bots because they don't need to be AI-driven. You know, there can be people behind multiple accounts.
And yeah, you'll see groups like 4chan, just everybody's got their army of them that they'll suddenly retweet everybody, and suddenly three people sound like they are 100 idiots. So it can be...
Scott Adams, creator of Dilbert, used to make sock puppet accounts on a forum I was on to talk about how smart he was.
I don't know if he's going to do that. But... But the point is that there are folks who are forcing the volume up on obnoxious things, and companies can deal with these if they want to, and if they actually want to have people addressing it and not trying to automate the entire process.
It's interesting because publicists are getting into this, and the Dilbert thing is interesting because you hear movies and like controversies will come up around movies,
games.
And it turns out later, there wasn't a controversy. It was five people, and the publicists got involved, and were like, "Oh, more people will see this movie if there's a controversy, because we'll appeal to the side that's like, well, that controversy is dumb, so I'm going to go see this in like protest of the protest."
Or you get company and company fighting. So anyone who saw the Bring Spider-Man Home hashtag, where you know there was the fight over who got to hold the rights to Spider-Man, whether it was going to go back to Marvel and Disney or stay with Fox, I guess?
Sony.
And a bunch of... It turns out someone did some digging, and the like Bring Spider-Man Home thing was like a lot of it was amplified by bots and sock puppets that belonged to Disney, and that they were stoking it to try and gain some leverage in the negotiations.
But also,
if you ever doubt that the mouse is evil, yeah, no, keep Tom Holland. Tom Holland is precious and must be protected.
To bring us back to the tech clash, let's also bring the audience in on this. What aspects of this sort of new or ongoing critique of technology resonates with you? I've got my own questions if there aren't questions out here at the moment, but looks like we've got somebody.
And what is your favorite Tom Holland moment?
I like him in the Final Fantasy trailer. He's training for Shadowbringers.
Nice.
Basically training for a video game. It's good. But my question is, I noticed you said you work for Mozilla, and a lot of people are actually moving away from Chrome and back to Firefox because of privacy concerns, where everything you type in Chrome before you hit enter is sent out to Google. So do you think that there are other companies that can take sort of a similar approach to privacy and respecting users' information in that way and grow an audience through that. Like, I think we know what good UX is, but maybe the other concerns can also drive an audience.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I think that there are teams working on Chrome and working on Safari that really do care a lot about user privacy and adding controls. And but I think that at the end of the day, the company's larger needs is going to make it tough for that work to get prioritized if it might hurt some other aspect of the business. And I think that companies that do work from a not-for-profit space, whether those are kind of like policy organizations like NGOs, whether it's an organization like Tactical Tech that provides, you know, training, free training for people on how to do kind of tactical self-defense, or organizations like Crypto Harlem, which kind of do work on the ground doing the same kind of thing. I think that having a organizational structure that lets your first commitment be to your users is always going to win out. I think if you look at Tumblr, Tumblr was for its users, and at some point they sold to Yahoo, and Yahoo said, we promise we're not going to screw this up. And whether they were good at making on that promise or not, then they sold to Verizon. And at the end of the day, the people at Tumblr weren't calling the shots anymore. And I think when the people who care about the user base don't get to call the shots, eventually it's going to come down to money. So I think any company that has the organizational ability to put customers first, or people first, depending on what their model is the one that's going to be able to really take those risks and do that, yeah.
Opera. Actually, do you want to poll the audience on this? Is anyone else as paranoid as me where you use Chrome for all your social and searches and Firefox for all your financials? Is anyone else that paranoid?
No, I do have a strategy like that. I
had a separate computer for different things. Yeah. All right, so I am the only one that paranoid. Okay.
I call what you're doing, like, if I want to do the social aspect, that's when I'm going on TV.
All right.
And the other part is...
What were you going to say about Opera?
Oh, I use all four browsers. I got a test in everything. But I do have each browser for its own separate purpose. So...
We have a question in the audience.
Well, you talk about what our observations are. I see the tech bash like everybody else does, but something I see among a lot of people I know is more of a tech retreat. Instead of dealing with it, lashing out at what happens to them on social media, they just say, I'm not going to participate. They go off of Twitter, they go off of Facebook, and be it like what I see a lot is, I have some Discord groups I deal with that are very focused to a specific group of people. And that's their Facebook now. They go there, and if there's anything out in the world happening, their friends post it there to them. And then it's kind of, they're kind of like depending on their friends in that little silo to curate their information for them. So you turn into these bunch of little groups that are circulating the same information.
And I love Discord, but I'm not giving it any more trust than I give Facebook.
Yeah,
that's my problem.
There's kind of two interesting things going on, I think, in this, and I think you're totally right. And if you look at young people and, like, you know, teenagers, I think that is also the trend, is to move towards these smaller group interactions. And there's kind of two things that are interesting in that to me. One is that a lot of these social networking companies have been so hyper-focused on growth that at some point you're going to saturate the market. Like, there are only so many people in the world who you can reliably get onto Facebook. And after that, where are you going to grow? And so I think that hyper-focus is going to have to start breaking down into focusing on other areas, probably pulling back some of the people who are starting to leave. The other is that there's a really fascinating line of research about how young people conceptualize privacy online. And a lot of what we hear in tech debates is everyone going like, well, it's all out there public. Why are you being so irrational about, you know, you post it on Facebook, you're posting it to the world, but no one thinks of it that way. And part of it is this idea that, like, well, humans are fundamentally very bad at risk assessment. We don't deal very well with big numbers. There are studies that show that basically most people, when you get to a number bigger than 1 million, cannot conceptualize it any longer. They just can't. We don't get orders of magnitude above that. And so when you're talking about your exposure where the denominator is in the billions, people just, you sort of blue screen. You just can't conceptualize that. So what they revert to is they revert to the availability heuristic, which basically says, in this context, young people think, they don't think of their privacy as how many people, how many possible actors can see what I'm posting online. It's, can my mom see it? Does my teacher see it? Does my best friend see it? Does the college admissions officer see it? And they think in terms of specific points of data that are immediately available to them that they care about. And so the result of this is that I think, you know, when things like Cambridge Analytica happen, I mean, this is why you see every time there's a big data breach, everyone suddenly cares about the privacy settings, you know, some for the first time. People are moving into smaller, more controlled environments where that math makes more sense. So you see people moving into smaller things like Discord or like Fortnite, which is apparently now a social network for teenagers. I don't get it. This is the first time I ever had to tell my boss, I don't understand kids these days. I'm 33. That was way earlier than I thought was going to happen. But you have this movement towards like smaller controlled groups where it is not necessarily like cabined, but it is much more controlled over who comes in and who goes out, and everyone's kind of no quantity. So those numbers of possible exposure just aren't quite as overwhelming.
You didn't spend enough time in muds and mushes.
Oh, I
those used to be the only.
I played a lot of muds.
Should have spent more time.
Moongate, my dude.
Oh, there you go.
Thank you.
Hello. I write down my question because I think it's kind of a complicated one. But first of all, I work in public relations. And just know that like artificially driving conversation is unethical, so we're not all bad. That was probably the marketing team who decided that. So. But, you know, audience and fan opinions are very important, and social media and digital has given, you know, the average person more opportunity than ever, really, to have a voice in this space. But in this situation with Disney and Sony, what do you think, or I should say, how much do you think situations like that where conversation was artificially driven to use as leverage in negotiations, how much do you think that that's going to end up just driving conversation back offline where important decisions are made? Or do you think that Pandora's box is already open and now we just have to figure out how to combat AI driving conversations artificially?
And live stream, my industry, it is the norm. I mean, if a live, if Ninja's gonna switch over to Mixer, there's gonna be a big, quiet push ahead of it. There's gonna be all sorts of controversy around it. There's gonna be all sorts of controversy as soon as he's off. And that's fully understood as part and parcel, and might as well make it part of your strategy rather than let it run wild. I think it's becoming the norm.
People are angry. I think people are angry about a lot of things in the world, and the internet gives them a place to talk about that, to feel like there are other people who are just as angry as they are. And there are a lot of these tech problems that I think actually have societal solutions, and we will need to address. Like, we're not going to make people less angry. There's a lot of bad stuff in the whole world, right? Like, it's just a reality, and people have valid angry feelings. But we need to come back and look at societal solutions to that. And I don't know if it's actually, some people will pull off, some people will dig in. But if we start looking at media literacy on how to read the news and making news better, because frankly, I can't tell who wrote a news story half the time anymore, let alone where it was written, let alone if it was an opinion piece or a reporting piece. So it's not only on people, it's on the other side as well. Trying to bring people back together, but I don't think that's a tech thing. I think that's a societal thing, and we're gonna have to separate them. So we're seeing societal issues that are having repercussions, and we're feeling the echoes in the tech space. And we have to know the solutions aren't all there, and that you're still gonna see people either cloister in small groups, or like go bigger and complain louder because of that.
I'd like to run with what Amy just said. In our last session on public policy, I talked about how everyone should be a citizen lobbyist. The same is true now for everyone needing to be a citizen journalist on those Discord channels, in your blogs, within all your various communities, tech, local. I try to do that within my actually neighborhood community, talk about what's going on at city council, that sort of thing, and of course within my industry. And I think that's now a responsibility for all of us to not just take in, to consume media, but to create it for everyone.
So one of the really fascinating things to me is that because we have seen, I'll preface this, I also study a lot of sci-fi. I call it studying because I have a job where I can
also
do that.
Reading.
I have a two-year-old, I don't read. I read audiobooks. And that's valid. Fight me. But one of the things that is interesting is, I was talking with some folks about this earlier, that sci-fi has predicted some things, and it is interesting. So in the case of like facial recognition technology, I think we have a much more visceral ick factor among the average person, partly because sci-fi predicted it, and we got the ick factor ahead of the actual technology landing. It was always presented as like a bad thing, so we're like, oh, what do you mean we're in Minority Report territory, where they're just like taking your face pictures everywhere, prescribed, da-da-da-da-da. We have a vocabulary, and that vocabulary has cast it as a negative, so that shapes how people respond to it. Otherwise, we are in an era of almost like volcanic social change, especially technological change. Like, one of the fascinating things about volcanoes is they literally drag up what is at the center of the Earth and bring it to the surface. And one of the things that this rapid pace of tech change has done is it has enabled a lot of underlying social ills that were there. They just weren't maybe audible or visible in the same way, and it has dragged them up to the surface occasionally in an explosion. And whether that's, I don't think that's, there's a normative judgment there. I think it's just the reality of what has happened. It is given visibility to the fact that there are, there's all kinds of crazy hate groups that are still very much out there, and now they're thriving, because they can see each other more visibly, that people still think like this. All the way to, marginalized communities suddenly having a voice and being like, hey, we've been targeted by the cops unfairly forever, and this is a problem. And so all of a sudden it is this, it's a fire hose of awareness of all of the things that are going on at once, and we as a society, the technology's gone faster than our ability as a society to adapt new norms around it, and how we interact with it, and how we interact with each other, in light of this ability to spontaneously communicate halfway across the globe with my, racist cousin on Facebook. And we are playing catch-up on this. Society is playing catch-up to the technology. And this has happened before in the human history. I mean, I have ancestors who were put out of jobs in English wool looms because the mechanical weaving apparatus came in. Fun fact, one of my great uncles was the last person executed on British soil because he led an uprising.
Luddite!
It was not very metal. They literally stuck a loaf of bread on a pike for some reason, and that was their banner. I do not know why. Anyway, family trivia aside. And part of the tech lash is, to echo what everybody's been saying, people are angry because they feel helpless, and it feels like we're grabbing onto the back of a speeding car. And we don't quite know how to get our feet under ourselves yet.
Okay.
Do we have another question?
We do.
Thank you.
I think it was Meredith. I think you mentioned something about certain scenarios where you come down on the same side as the tech companies, and sometimes you come down on the side of the opposite. Like, what are some examples of either side that you agree with the tech?
So, I mean, one thing that we have worked a lot on in my office, and I will caveat this by saying I am not the expert. I mostly deal with music licensing, which is a much weirder, less sort of science-y issue a lot of the time. Antitrust and consolidation and competition is a big thing where we're looking at, especially things like Amazon, and their impact on the retail market online, and their impact on small sellers, and their power as a platform to extract information and charges. Things like I work on Twitch, on YouTube, the power of YouTube to functionally dictate what like fair use law in copyright is. What the actual law says is way less relevant to most people than what YouTube seems to think fair use is. And so we fight with them about that stuff with some frequency. At the same time, we deal with things like the EU Copyright Directive, which was, you know, just a generally not a, I'm gonna keep my, that's for another panel. It was not great, Bob. And the short version is, like, that was based on a fundamental, deliberate, in some ways, misunderstanding of how these platforms operate and the capacity that they have. And we can have an argument about the normative, like, aspect of should they be dealing at such scales that they no longer have the capacity to monitor everything that comes across the platform. But that's a very different discussion than the one that was happening, which is, oh no, it's fine that they operate at, like, you know, millions of seconds of video every minute uploaded or whatever, but we just think they should be looking at all of it. And that's a very different discussion. So, you know, I think there is not a lot of room for nuance in politics, which is universally true. It becomes doubly true when you're talking about something as necessarily complex as tech. And so we end up on both sides of these fights with some frequency.
Another question?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you for the panel. Andrew, I also use multiple browsers, like you mentioned, and I did install the DragonCon app. It seems like a decent app, but it required a ridiculous amount of permissions. But my question is on the Internet of Things. I don't want a Wi-Fi enabled refrigerator or microwave or anything.
Is there any car?
Yeah. Is there any kind of labeling that's going out there? Like, I mean, there was Energy Star labeling for energy efficient devices. Any kind of labeling for people who just don't want gratuitous technology in their devices?
Short answer, yes. Longer answer, there's a number of kind of competing trust marks and labeling systems and standards that a number of companies and organizations are working on. The Internet Society is working on some. Conglomerations of manufacturers like Samsung are working on others. Organizational standards bodies like NIST have developed their own. But there isn't really one true sign to rule them all. I think part of the problem is that it's tough to get enough IoT manufacturers or standards people in a room to agree on what level they should be looking at things at. Like, should they actually be providing standards for the way the tech works? Should they be providing standards for the way in which it's developed? Should they be providing standards from a consumer point of view as far as what the person can do with it? So there's a lot of work happening in that space. I don't know that there's a single thing I would point at that I would say, this is working great.
So there's a prerequisite to this, and I want to say this for any engineers in the room who aren't aware of it, because there's a process that you can participate in right now. The NTIA, which is the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, it's a government agency through the Department of Commerce, is working on what they're calling the SBOM, which is the Software Bill of Materials that go into connected devices. All of the things that make up the thing. And so that process about what that would look like, where it would be used, all of that stuff, which will feed these labeling pieces, because you can't label something accurately if you don't know what it's built on top of. That process is ongoing right now. If you go to the NTIA, DC loves acronyms, if you go to that website, they will, the information is there to participate in it. The calls and the meetings take place in DC. The meetings take place in DC, but they are public and you can join them remotely and participate. I haven't kept up with it as well, especially since I switched jobs, but I highly recommend that as a process leading into making these labeling systems better. And it's something you can get involved with right now. So if you're looking for something to do, there's a call to action.
That's maybe a good place to move to, is with this techlash, how can it be directed towards good? And so when you're thinking about the ways that you're angry at the tech companies or certain online communities that are messing up your day or endangering your friends, what should the audience and we be doing to sort of step up?
So right now, I'm wearing my Our Games, Our Rights, VideoGamerVotersNetwork.org lanyard, and the anti-game hype politicized a lot of people who would have otherwise had no interest, teens just getting to voting age especially, who otherwise would have had no interest in the process, suddenly found something they cared a great deal about being threatened and got involved. And while this organization has kind of got less enthusiasm as the threat has receded, it still exists and became a reason for people to get involved. And I will say that for people to get involved is the number one benefit that can come out of any of these things.
So I've thought about this a lot. I'm going to give you a piece of advice to take home. Solutions to these problems are really hard. So the next time you get angry, I ask actually that you take a step back, you ask what you're angry about, and you look at the solution a little bit more holistically, and then ask what can be done to fix this, and how can it fix just the problem without creating more problems? So there are a lot of us who see the issue, we see the problems, and we're working really hard on trying to get to a good place. But anytime someone says, this is really easy, all you have to do is X, that's probably wrong. Like, this 99.99, et cetera, percent of the time that's wrong, because no problem has that easy of a solution. So we need to be thinking, like, what would you write down? And what is a policy that you could apply evenly and equally and equitably that would solve for that? And having more voices thinking through those things and not getting angry and proposing just really easy solutions that won't solve would so much help the situation. It'll help us get to a better place. It'll stop driving the conversation in negative downward spirals. And it's really vitally important because people where allies are attacking allies and people who should be working in the same direction are going after each other, and it's getting harder to come to solutions, not easier. And so I give to all of you and give to one other person today to like, how would you write down the solution? And if you can write down the solution and then start sharing it and talking about it, I think it'll help this so much.
I will say that one, wholeheartedly agree with Amy. I think bringing in thoughtfulness and nuance to this is probably the best medicine for a lot of what is going on right now. Having said that, this is a complicated issue, and a lot of folks are still, you know, civil society, especially groups that work on this, are still in a lot of these issues in the vocabulary building stage of figuring out exactly what the harms are. What do we mean by privacy? This is a thing people have been tearing their hair out over for years, and we're still kind of starting to settle on maybe a mutually agreeable definition in some cases. There's a lot of folks who think about this stuff professionally. I'd encourage you to join Tech Policy Twitter, Tech Policy Girl Gang. Didn't even realize I was going to have to plug my own shirt. Seriously, start, you know, find some people who you think have very thoughtful critiques, follow that. I dunk on Twitter constantly, but I'm on it all the time. Because it's where a lot of this discussion happens. So follow them, follow those dialogues. We argue with each other on Twitter all the goddamn time. It's part of my job. And we go back and forth on these things. You will get all the different conflicting points of view. You'll get about this would impact this, well, this would impact the other thing. So if you're extremely online, tap into Tech Policy Twitter. It is a more thoughtful space than a lot of Twitter happens to be, which is, I know, a super low bar, but we do our most of the time, we clear it. And you know, if you are, you know, if that is, people are busy, if you just want to read, you know, follow the news, follow a couple of reporters who you have, you know, seen take very thoughtful approaches to this. Follow what they write, follow the dialogue that they get involved in. You know, and just keep, there's so much nuance here that asking anyone to jump into it, it's like jumping into the Mariana's Trench. Like, you can just go all the way down, you know, and that's a huge amount of time and investment. So just follow people who think about this, who you think are nuanced and thoughtful, and get involved in the discussion that way.
At EF Forums on Twitter.
I'm going to give a different answer to this than I normally do. I agree with everything everyone said. But I think that a thing that people can really do that is really effective and kind of is a force multiplier is to donate money. So when you get mad about a thing, when you're upset about the thing, figure out who's working to fight it and donate money. If you're mad about how all the programmers in Silicon Valley are old white dudes, donate $10 to Black Girls Code. If you're mad about the erosion of civil liberties and freedom of speech, when you get mad about it, donate $10 to the EFF. When you find yourself bumping up against these walls and frustrated about a thing, there's 100 people doing that work, there's 100 organizations that have spent tireless hours preparing free tools or filing court briefs. Give them $10 every time you're mad, because they can take that money, and if they get enough of it, they can use it in ways that individuals really can't at that scale. So use the cash you have, use the money you have, and give it to the organizations that are doing that work, because you know they're not getting Amazon money, they're not getting Google money.
I will also plug very quickly, if you are, especially if you're part of an organized group of any kind, and there is an issue in tech policy that affects you directly, contact people who work on this. We have, you know, I do copyright work, I filed briefs with the Supreme Court with cosplay groups, because there are copyright concerns that affect them. And, you know, for better or for worse, meaning for worse, DC kind of exists in a bubble a lot of the time, and we don't have eyes on the ground to how this is affecting real groups.
That's a great place for us to wrap up, though.
And if you're in a profession, join the trade association and push their dialogue the direction you want to go.
Thank you, everyone. This has been a great panel. We'll be here for more.